There can be bad language and adult concepts in this program. So please watch out for little ears if you've got your podcast playing and pop on some headphones. That way no one can get offended but you. Rights for Women would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land upon which this podcast is recorded throughout Australia. We recognise their continuing connection to land, waters and culture. We recognise that sovereignty has never been ceded and pay respects to elders past, present and emerging. You're listening to the Rights for Women podcast, where we celebrate women writers, support women's rights and talk all things women and writing. I'm Kel Butler, podcaster and wannabe author. I'm founder of Listen Up Podcasting, where we make podcasts for a positive world. Check me out at www.listenuppodcasting.com.au or find me on Facebook.
And I'm Pamela Cook, author of 5 novels, 4 traditionally published and 1 indie release. I'm a writing teacher and a podcaster. My latest release, Cross My Heart, is available now at all online retailers and at pamelacook.com.au.
Listen to all of our episodes at www.rightsforwomen.com or subscribe wherever you get your pods.
Today on Rights for Women, we welcome Eva Ramsey to the Convo Couch. Eva is the debut author of The Morbids, published by Allen & Unwin. She was a prize winner in the 2016 Newcastle Short Story Competition, has written for numerous journals and blogs, and is the production manager for the Newcastle Writers Festival and on the board of the National Young Writers Festival. Eva, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Pamela, nice to be here.
Great to chat. When is the first time that you thought you might want to be a writer?
I don't remember not wanting to be a writer. I mean, technically I do, and it was for a period in my sort of 20s and 30s when I was too scared to, but I was writing stories from as far back as I can remember. I always had a little book of stories that I was working on from when I learned to write. We had a little very old 2-colour PC back in the day, and I would write novels on that, a chapter a page or a page a chapter and 6 chapters long and be like, oh, it's a book.
Yay.
And I remember if I had a sick day from school, I'd go into work with my mum and sit in an empty office and just write, fill notebooks, and at the end of the day I'd be like, I've written 32 stories today. So it's something I've always wanted to do, but I did end up sort of putting it on the back burner as I got older. I got a bit of anxiety around it and really just felt very exposed anytime I sort of shared my writing with anybody, so it took a back seat until I sort of dealt with all of that, and so here we are.
Yeah. That's a really interesting thing, actually, because I think that's a very common story for writers and anybody in creative life, is sort of actually getting to the point where you feel comfortable sort of, I guess, putting your work out there and comfortable sort of admitting, you know, I'm a writer. How did you think you got to that point where you could say, yes, I'm a writer, this is what I want to do, and actually, you know, throwing yourself more back into it?
There was a fair bit of therapy involved, I won't lie. The other thing was I was working in sort of adjacent industries. So I was working in magazine publishing and doing a little bit of writing in my role for that for a couple of tech titles. And then I went on maternity leave and ended up moving up to Newcastle, and I got involved with the National Young Writers Festival at the tender age of, I think, 34, which is a year off the cutoff for the National Young Writers Festival. But I
is it 35, is it, the cutoff?
It's 35.
Yeah.
Or for artists it is anyway.
Right.
And I was at that point, you know, I'd occasionally start a blog and then neglect the blog, or I'd write a short piece, but I never had the courage to put anything out there. And I'm sure Candace is so sick of me telling this story, but I met Candace Fox, who is the crime writer. She was there that year, and she just asked me, do you write? And I did a very big umming and ahhing, and and she's like, if you write, you're a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason that was a bit of a breakthrough for me, and it made me a little bit less scared to call myself a writer. And it made me think, like, I think everything that weekend was just so transformative watching everyone talking about writing and all these young people so passionate about writing. And I came away from that weekend feeling like maybe this was something I could actually do. And it still took a while to get the courage to really take that somewhere, but it was the first time I'd seen a writing community, and it was the first time that I'd really felt like it was okay to fail almost.
Yeah.
Which is important.
And it's sort of part of the process.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's horrible, but
it is actually, isn't it? It's part of the process, but I think it also helps thicken your skin a bit too.
Mm.
Yeah. And so you sort of cut your teeth, I guess, on writing articles and shorter pieces, short stories.
Yeah.
And how important do you think that was, doing that and sort of honing your craft before you went into full-blown, you know, longer form fiction?
I think there's a discipline to short story writing that, honestly, I probably don't have. I find short stories are great because if you have a kernel of an idea and you can develop something really quickly, and then obviously you hone it and you work on it over a longer period of time, but it's easy to see a complete product really quickly. So it almost gives you that slight bit of instant gratification to keep going. You know, I write quite fast, so I can put together 1,000 or 2,000 word piece in a day, but then obviously polish it over months. But you come away from that, you're like, right, I've written something. And whereas novel writing, you don't feel like you're getting anywhere for the longest time. So I think it gave me that little bit of confidence, and having those couple of early wins when I started writing short stories and having them sort of picked up for the Newcastle Short Story Prize and the Herald Prize was just, it made me think that maybe I wasn't a completely talentless hack.
Which is always good.
Yeah. And I, before that, obviously when I did write for some magazines, I think working with editors was just great because you got that pretty quick feedback on your work and constant encouragement. I think it was actually quite hard switching to fiction because there's nobody there for so much of it to tell you whether what you're doing is working. And you need to sort of have your own that faith in yourself. So it took a while to build up to novel writing, but as soon as I did, I felt like I need more words. So.
So you sort of felt like you had that urge to write something in a longer form. Is that what drew you then into that novel writing form?
Yeah, it was a little bit of an accident. The opening part of The Morbids, actually I will go back. So I had done a couple of NaNoWriMos for other things before, which is the National Novel Writing Month, which is 50,000 words we do in November. But nothing had ever really gelled. It was more of an exercise of how many words can I spew out on a page. And then I went back to sort of the short fiction, and I was just writing these little experimental pieces. And the opening scene of The Morbids, which is where we meet the Morbids themselves, was one of the pieces I wrote. And I wrote it and then I put it away for a little while and worked on some other things. And it wasn't until a bit later that I joined a writing group, and Cherie, a friend of mine, asked me just to submit a piece, and I went back and I was looking through the things I'd done, and I found this piece and I thought, this could be something more. And even then I didn't know if it was a novel or a novella or just a longer short story. And it really kind of grew quite organically from there. I think it was, okay, well, we have this scene and we have this character, and where can we put this character now, and what does this character do next? And I didn't know it was a novel until a little way into the process. So okay. it was an accident, but
yeah
it was nice sticking to the one character for a little bit longer than in a short story where you write a character and then you have to let them go straight away.
Yeah So you get to see that character grow and develop. And did you have that experience that the character took on a life of her own, your protagonist, Caitlin?
Very much. I feel the way I describe it, I don't know if it sounds a bit funny, is I feel like I was making a new friend. So, you know, sometimes you meet those people and you have that instant connection, like that you're almost kindred spirits, and or you go out and you have a couple of bottles. I want to say glasses, but it's probably bottles of wine. And you think, I was like, she's the most interesting person. And then as I don't plan. So instead I revised. So I had her out on the page and probably the first draft written in about 6 weeks. And it was this very feverish, like, yep, I know exactly who Caitlin Lynn is. I know exactly what Caitlin wants. I know exactly where Caitlin's going. And then going back into the revisions is like after that first flush of friendship, getting to know somebody a lot better. Mm. And she would sort of come to me and go, hang on, that's not actually what I think. Or how about I do this instead? And yeah, so I think of her as a little friend that lived in my head for a while and told me her stories and let me get to know her over the period of a good, I think, 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
Probably. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So tell us about The Morbids, because there'd be people listening who don't know what the book's about. So in your own words, could you tell us what it is about?
Yep, not a problem. It is. So The Morbids is a support group for a group of people who think they're going to die in various ways. So we've got Jeff, who's really concerned that he's going to have a dryer fall off the wall and hit him in the head. And then Carlos, who is terrified of car accidents to the point where he doesn't drive. Franny is convinced she's got cancer. And then there's Caitlin, who has a range of fears. The main one that she talks about is being, you know, mugged and assaulted off the street and then killed. And they meet every Tuesday in a sort of an empty office building with a health professional who sort of isn't particularly maybe well equipped to deal with them and discuss this fear. And so it's a ragtag support group for people with this death anxiety. And we follow Caitlin, who is our main character, as she comes to terms with what has happened to her in the past and figures out how to live again, basically. So her best friend is getting married in Bali, and then she meets a man through her work and starts to have to face up to what's happened in her past. And it's really about facing your fears and living life and coming to terms with your past and finding ways to move forward and finding ways to live when you think it's easier not to.
It's a really interesting topic, because I think it's something that we can all relate to on some level. You know, that idea of death anxiety. I don't think there'd be many people out there who don't have that occasional thought and think, you know, oh, I could have died, or what's going to happen to me when I die. So I think we do all, to some extent, have that. And I think that's why, you know, it is sort of easy in some ways to relate to Caitlin. But of course, you know, as you say, in The Morbids, which is the sort of therapy group that she attends, this is anxiety taken to its extreme. Yeah. So where did that idea come from for you? Like, did that just come as part of Caitlin's character, or did you read about it somewhere, or where did it come from?
I think it came pretty organically, but I myself have a lot of anxiety and a lot around death. I also have a lot of sort of social anxieties and general anxieties, but I am the kind of person that if I'm on a train platform, I never walk too close to the edge because I'm worried I'm going to fall over. I didn't
get my drivers. Me too. That's me. I have to stand with like a wall or something at my back. It's crazy.
I'm like, I never trip over when I'm walking, but if I'm on a train platform, I'm convinced. I'm convinced I'm going to trip over my own 2 feet. I didn't get my driver's license until I was 35, I think, because I was so terrified about driving. And I won't drive on a freeway. You know, I still have that. Anything where I've got to merge at speed, not good.
Right.
So I have a lot of those things, and I do, as much as, you know, I feel like I live a pretty ordinary life. I was pulling the washing out of my washing machine the other night underneath the wall-mounted dryer and thinking, gee, I hope it doesn't fall on me. And they're all things that, like in the opening scene of The Morbids, they start off kind of comic, and it's really, you know, but it can sometimes stop you doing things. Like, there was a long time where there were certain jobs I couldn't do, or certain things I'd have to give up because I couldn't drive. And it was easier. I lived in Sydney for a long time. I live in Newcastle now. When we first moved up to Newcastle, it was a lot harder because Sydney has, you know, a greater public transport culture than Newcastle does. And I found myself quite isolated in Newcastle because not being able to drive. So I could see how it would start to affect your life if you really took that to an extreme, and because it was affecting my life and generally anxiety as well. I mean, I've had a lot of it. I've had a lot of therapy for it. I feel like I deal with it relatively well, but it's something I've lived with for for as long as I can remember. So writing an anxious character came pretty easily to me.
Yeah. So you're able to draw on your own experience, but then you take it to those extremes, you know, for the other characters.
Yeah.
And you capture that sort of sense of anxiety really well, because we see Caitlin, you know, we see that the whole story is told through Caitlin's point of view, and we see her mind, almost her imagination, like running away with her at various points in time, you know, sometimes for quite long periods, where she's imagining all these things that are going to happen to her.
Yeah.
And, you know, how did you, like, did that writing, in the writing of the story, did those sorts of descriptions come pretty naturally, like in your drafting process, or, you know, how much of that did you sort of have to revise and go back and refine?
I think most of those came pretty organically. I think the sort of the longer bits of anxiety and stress did come pretty naturally, and they were almost something I think in the process that I did have to cut back on. I think when it came to editing, it was maybe there was some of those passages were a bit too long, or maybe there were a few too many of them. So, you know, I really tried to distill it down into something, and especially Caitlin, one problem Caitlin has a lot is that she doesn't sleep. And that experience of lying in bed, just really wanting to be asleep and not knowing what you can do to get there, and winding yourself up and having the anxiety get worse and worse and make you more and more awake, and watching the time, and, you know, hearing a truck or hearing a bird, and knowing that you're not going to get to sleep.
Yeah.
And so that stuff, I mean, I've been there, so it was really, really easy to write about, I think.
Yeah.
You know,
I know, I could relate to a lot of that too. I'm sure a lot of readers will. Yeah. I think we've all had periods of insomnia for various reasons at some stage. Yeah.
Definitely.
But as you say, there's a lot of humour, like, in this, the book as well. I think because some of the things are so extreme, you know, the way that Caitlin and some of the other characters in the Morbids think, that on one level there is this sort of sense of humour about it all. But, of course, there's this much more serious underlying, you know, issue that they're all dealing with. So how did you find sort of balancing that, you know, line between humour and seriousness, I guess, in terms of the issues you were dealing with?
I think that was a tricky thing, and it took a lot of back and forth to get it right. Or, I mean, I hope it's right. I think there is a natural instinct when you, maybe with a lot of mental illnesses, but I think with anxiety, it feels like a little bit more to, because it does make you do things that can be a little bit funny. Sort of, it's the same way OCD has become a thing where, you know, it's very misunderstood because we think it's these sort of slightly comical, not stepping on cracks type things, which it's not. And it's massively debilitating. But there are those, the little kernels in there of behaviours that, taken on their own, are kind of, can be a bit amusing until they're not. And I think, you know, where I really wanted to go with the story is I wanted to bring people in with a little bit of that humour and a little bit of that warmth, and then take it to a point maybe it's a little bit more uncomfortable, because, you know, anxiety is, it's a low-lying level thing until the day you can't get out of bed.
Yeah.
And I really, I wanted to find that balance, and I wanted to be kind to my characters as well. You know, I didn't want to be mean to them. I didn't want to make them jokes, but I did want to make them people who have dealt with this for a long time, and so maybe can make the odd joke about it, you know.
Yeah.
And I think it was a really, it was a balance, and I sometimes, you know, I struggle to, sometimes you don't know whether you've got that quite right even now, but you can only hope.
Well, I'm finding that you did, so well done.
Thank you.
The other thing that's really lovely in the book is this, I mean, there are difficulties in it, but the friendship between Caitlin and Lena, which is a really central relationship in the book. Can you talk a little bit about that friendship and sort of maybe where you got the inspiration from for that, and how you, without giving away any spoilers, how that develops through the course of the book? Yeah.
Sure. So Caitlin's best friend, Lena, they've been best friends since they were in high school, and Lena, I think, moved next door. And they have very different home lives. Lena had, her parents had just divorced when they met, and she had a lot of problems with her parents, whereas Caitlin's sort of, you know, come from a bit more of a stable background. But through high school, Caitlin, because of that, ended up being sort of the more supportive character of the, you know, she felt like she had to look after Lena and protect Lena from the things that were going on in her world. And what's happened later in the book is that Caitlin's faced her own difficulties and has really struggled to realign herself as the person in that relationship that needs help. And so where that's left Caitlin is really pushing Lena away and isolating herself. And Lena is trying to be there for her, but it, you know, it's a challenge. And we come at it with these two characters who've barely spoken for several months, and Lena's getting married and she really wants Caitlin to be her maid of honor, and Caitlin's doing everything she can to avoid her, but also feeling incredibly guilty about it, which is not helping anything either. And I guess as to where it came from, I mean, I have a best friend that I've had since high school. Our relationship is extremely different to Caitlin and Lena's, but there are, I do find it interesting the way you do cast yourself in these roles with these friendships that form in adolescence. They're so incredibly intense. Like, you know, I remember the days, the nights spent as a teenager talking to my best friend. We'd be on the phone for 4 hours, we'd be having sleepovers, and we'd be up all night. You know, it's this, it's an incredibly intense time in your life, and the people you share it with, you form these incredible bonds with. But then as you get older, these things start to happen. You know, you start going your own way, whether, you know, sometimes someone gets married earlier or someone doesn't, people travel, people don't travel. As your worlds get bigger, that friendship gets stretched, and there's such a tension there as you try and figure out who you are versus who your friend is and whether you can still be friends. And I think that I found that such an interesting topic to really get into and dive right into. But it, in the writing process, funnily enough, it came quite late. I think in the original drafts, Lena was a very minor support character. And every draft, it was like she took on a bigger role and then a bigger role and then a bigger role. And it wasn't until I sort of found the you know, that friendship and really brought it out to its final form that the book really, really came together. So it was always there in my head, but it took me a long time to get it.
It's almost like you were sort of peeling away the layers and bringing, you know, like they talk about that idea of the Statue of David, you know, always being inside the marble, and it's like you're peeling it away and getting to the actual core of it.
Yeah, definitely.
Again, I think it's something that a lot of readers, particularly women readers, would relate to, that idea of that long-term friendship and the stresses and strains that we have around those relationships.
Yeah, I hope people can relate to it. I mean, I think it's got so many sides to it. It, you know, these people that you've known for a long time, they have your back. No matter what happens, you know they have your back. But sometimes when things are difficult, that can feel a bit too much, my words, but you know, it can feel a little bit too intense to turn to the person who's always known you, because they know you and they can call you on all your crap, and they can, like, you know, you can't hide anything from them. They know you're hiding it. And so I know what Caitlin tends to do is she sort of pulls herself away from Lena and instead goes out drinking and partying with her workmates, because they don't know her, and she can pretend to them like there's nothing wrong. And I think we all like to do that, you know, especially when you're struggling. Sometimes being near people who don't know that you're struggling can actually be a little bit safer and easier than worrying about what people are thinking about you, I think.
Yeah, and you don't have to, you know, you can put up the pretense. It's almost like, you know, you're a different version of yourself in those different situations and with different people, which Caitlin is, isn't she?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I mean, I'm the first person to always, you know, I meet a new person and within 5 minutes they probably know that I have anxiety, because I'm very, very open about it. But I also love, I had a hard time a little while ago, and then I was dropping something off at a friend's house and she was like, come in, we're having tea. And there were like four or five people there that I'd never met before, and ended up drinking tea for an hour and a half and just talking about community gardens. And you know, there was no one was like, are you okay? No one was like, how are you holding up? It was just this really nice release, and you're still connected to people and you're still near people, but you don't feel like everyone's looking at you waiting for you to fall apart. Mm. And I think, I know that was something that for Caitlin, she doesn't want. She doesn't want to be the victim. She doesn't want to be the broken one. And
yeah,
so it's easier to find people who don't know about that and to hide it.
And of course, the issue, as you say, is in their relationship is around Lena getting married. She's going to be married elsewhere. And so there is this sort of romantic thread, I guess, through the story. And there is someone that Caitlin meets as well. Mm. How did you go about integrating that sort of aspect of the storyline, you know, in with all the other issues that you were dealing with?
Oh, gosh. I am a hopeless romantic. I'm not going to lie. You know, I grew up on a diet of Sweet Dreams books and various romances. So in a way, sometimes the balance was keeping too much of that romance, keeping it so the romance wasn't the overlying arch of the book, because I have that soft, gooey center that really just says, hey, you know, wouldn't it be, you know, I grew up rom-coms and all of that. So I really, you know, that bit came the easiest, and honestly, it was sort of paring that back as I went. And I was really determined that, again, without giving out spoilers, that the romantic relationship was not going to be what fixed Caitlin. You know, I find that it's a trope that we sort of come to a lot where, you know, especially when we deal with sort of mental illness in women's fiction, there's this sort of instinct of, you know, the woman has a breakdown and then the man comes along and makes it all better. And I really didn't want the man to be the person who came along and did that.
Yeah.
And I hope I've achieved it. Again, now that it's out in personal opinion, you know, everyone can have their own opinions about whether I've done that or not. But I think the romantic side of it is again, I think it's bringing a little bit of warmth and light and something hopeful to what is otherwise a difficult story sometimes. Mm,
yeah. Like you say, it gives it that balance between, you know, and it's, I mean, Caitlin's a single 28-year-old woman, so, you know, and it's a natural progression for her to be, you know, in romantic relationships. So, and it's an interesting comparison to see the way she deals with, you know, a romantic sort of story, I guess, or a romantic thread for her, as opposed to Lena, you know, who is all about getting married and living the happily ever after type thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I think Caitlin, you know, it's quite funny, Lena announces she's getting married, and Caitlin has a lot of issues with that, and she has a lot of issues with the whole wedding side of it. You know, I think she is a bit gobsmacked that Lena wants to go to Bali and hire out an entire resort to get married. She thinks it's a little bit ridiculous. You know, Lena buys a house and Caitlin is happy for her, but at the same time, I think she's a bit like, why would you want to do that? you know, and when she meets Tom and they get closer, Caitlin has a lot of reservations about getting into a relationship with him. You know, it's not something she sees in herself before, you know, in her past life, before she sort of started to break down. She would only ever have relationships with these very successful men who basically she could count on to treat her as a plaything and then move on. She never wanted really that commitment, and I think it scared her for various reasons that do become obvious in the book. I think there's some history there, and you know, she's it takes a while for her to warm up to Tom and to warm up to the idea of being in a relationship. And even then, when she is originally, it doesn't necessarily go well for her. I think she hopes that it will fix everything, and it doesn't, because, you know, she needs to do the work herself.
She's got her own work to do, sure. Exactly. And the postcards are a really lovely addition to the story.
Yeah, I love the postcards. They're one of my favourite things. So what happens is in the book, as they're teenagers, Lena and Caitlin start sort of planning an overseas trip, which they want to take as they get older. And they plan this a lot through postcards that they send each other. They live next door to each other, but they will go to various op shops and buy sort of old postcards from usually deceased estates and send them to each other. And you know, there's this thing where the Lena will put little fun facts about wherever the postcards are from on the bottom. It's a cute thing. And it gives them this other way of communicating that I just love. I just love the world where everything is so instantaneous and I can message any of my friends from all over the world. I love taking a moment to write something and then post it and then wait. There's like a week or two if it's overseas or even in Australia at the moment, because I know, you know, Australia Post is really stretched. So
yeah, true.
You know, it's this very slow way of communicating.
Yeah.
Different to the instantaneous way that we communicate now, and it changes the dynamic of it. And I found that really interesting. And I loved it with postcards as well, because when you write postcards, I know I am always thinking of whether the mailman is going to read it. So it was balanced.
Oh, yeah, true.
These deeply personal thoughts that these women were having with things that you'd feel comfortable putting on a postcard. And so it lets you sort of distill it into, it's almost like there's a second language there, because yeah, they know what each other's talking about. But the postman would just read it and be like, who are these people? And
yeah, like there's a bit of a code going on. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And the idea actually came, I have a really good friend in Melbourne who a while ago started what she called a mail club. And it was just this very sweet thing where she would post occasionally on social media. She's like, if anyone needs some mail to cheer you up, let me know. And one of the things she would often send out was postcards, and she would get them from op shops. And so that I stole the idea from her. And yeah, it's such a, there's actually someone I follow on Twitter in the States at the moment who started this thing called Pen Pal Palooza. I don't know how to pronounce it, where she's locked down in New York, and she's basically started sort of a Kris Kringle service to get people all over the world pen pals. And it's all over.
Wow.
Thousands and thousands and thousands of people writing each other letters. And I find it so lovely that, you know, especially when we're all locked down and we're all at home all the time, people are finding these new ways, old ways, but new ways to connect.
To connect, which is so important, isn't it, at the moment, especially as you say, we're, you know, people being in lockdown, people being isolated, and just being able to think, you know, what are they going to get in the mail? Who can they, you know, hear from, who can they communicate with, stuff like
that.
So you were saying, Eva, that, you know, you wrote the book over a period of about 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. So you did your drafts and you got it to a certain point. When was the point where you thought, oh, I can actually show this to someone, or I think that I might be able to approach a publisher with this?
It took about a year. Maybe even a little bit less. So as I said, the first draft came out really quickly. It took about sort of 6 weeks, and then I sat on it for a little bit, went back in, and then gave it a polish, and gave it just to a friend of mine she's read a few other things I've written, and she's always just super enthusiastic. And you know, when you just want someone to say, yeah, that's good. And she started reading it, and straight away she's like, this is really, really good. You've got to do something with this.
Okay.
And honestly, I felt like I'd hit something. You never can tell.
Yeah.
And I've written other things in the past where I've been like, this is it. And then I've reread it a month later and thought that was not it. Whereas this, every time I came back to it, I was like, there's something here. There's something here. And I sent it off to a friend that I had, and she sort of agreed with me, a friend through the Writers Festival. So someone with a little bit more industry knowledge, and she was like, yeah, there's definitely something here. So that gave me the courage to then approach my agent, who had, you know, was so instrumental in then turning it into what it's become. So
okay.
Yeah. I mean, it is a thing where that's another great thing about the Young Writers Festival and writers festivals in general, is you start to make connections, and it's not like you can ever send your work to someone you meet at these things and have it be immediately published, but there are other writers and there are people in the industry who can, beyond a certain point, once you are friends, you know, you can have a chat to them about your work and get some feedback and things like that. So yeah. Definitely extremely lucky to have that. And yeah.
And Alan and Unwin published the book.
Yeah.
That's sort of your... Was that your choice? Like, was that your dream? You know, when you thought about, you know, I want to have my book published, did you sort of have a scenario in your head of, you know, what was your dream journey to publication?
I remember before I had submitted it anywhere, and I was still, I think, writing it with my writers group and having coffee with a friend from my writers group. And she was like, where would you have it published? And I was like, I didn't know anything about publishers at this point, honestly, but I... knew that Alan and Unwin sent a lot of people to the Newcastle Writers Festival that I worked on. And I was like, they seem really great. They're always really enthusiastic. Yeah. And you know, they're always really great. They seem to put all their titles up on social media really well. They seem really sort of progressive and modern, and they would be great. But I didn't, you know, at that point it was a pipe dream. And but you know, I think I actually sent the book to them before I sent it to my agent through their slush pile and didn't hear anything back. And I was just like, oh. It was in a very different form. And it was, you know, the way slush piles sort of work is they wanted, I think, one chapter or something. So it's this very, you have 30 seconds to capture their attention. Yeah. And they have so many submissions. I hold it against them in no way at all. It's, you know, sometimes you just got to keep trying. And then I sent it off to my agent, and when she was putting it out on submission, it was really clear. Alan and Unwin were super enthusiastic from the beginning. I mean, she sent it out, and I think the next day she's like, when can you get down and meet with Alan and Unwin? Oh, they want to see you straight away. I went in there and I met with a whole team from the publishing director down, and they were all just so nice and so lovely and so supportive. And I think they really sort of seemed to get what I was trying to do. They didn't try and put it into a different box or change it to become either more commercial or more literary. And I think it does fall in a weird space there. So
yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Like when you were writing it, or, you know, like getting into those final stages, did you sort of have in your head where it fitted, like genre-wise, or you sort of, you didn't really know or care? Or
I didn't know. I think I had this dream of it being this, you know, there was an earlier subplot that I cut out that was very dark and sort of, not even dark, but just kind of edgy, I guess. Edgy is a better word for it. And you know, there was more drugs, there was more, more everything. Yeah. And it felt like I was trying to write a certain kind of book, you know, a little bit more literary, a little bit darker, a little bit more risky, I guess. And I think risky is the wrong word, but it wasn't me. I think that's where I started to feel, is more than anything from anyone else, it felt like it really felt like it wasn't me. Like I was trying to do something because I thought it seemed cool. And you know, I think there is a bit of a, when you grow up in a certain environment, a little bit of snobbery around sort of the commercial versus the literary. And so, you know, I remember having a really early conversation with my agent. She said, very commercial. And I was almost like, oh.
Oh, is it?
Why would you say that? and then she's like, it's not a bad thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But you do, you know, you look at, I think it's hard to reconcile where you sit in that way. And I've got so much self-doubt, and I struggle a lot with so many things and self-belief. So when people would ask me comparison titles, I just hated comparing myself to any book that had actually been published, because I thought, well, how dare I compare myself to any other book? So that was really hard. And it's really somewhere where I let my agent and then Alan Unwin guide me, because I just felt like, you know, which is not to say that they came in and went, no, you've got to make this more commercial, you've got to do this. It was much more me going, well, actually the story I want to tell is this one, and them being supportive in that and going, well, if that's the story you want to tell, then this is how we do it, and this is where it will sit. And that's the thing, Alan and Unwin have been amazing with supporting me in the vision for the book. And And yeah, you know, obviously when it was edited, there were lots of notes and things like that, but it was all about tightening up the story. It wasn't reframing it to fit
right.
a mold or something. So
yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah. So they were really, like you say, supporting you and you in having your own voice and telling the story you wanted to tell.
Yeah.
Brilliant. The,
yeah.
So how has the whole debut experience been for you? I mean, it's been COVID time, so that's been a complication, I know, and it's been tricky for a lot of authors having books out this year, but how have you found the whole debut experience?
I think I've gotten a little bit lucky. I've managed to avoid, obviously Melbourne and Victoria's locked down, but I have managed to avoid being locked down, I guess, here in Newcastle as the book actually came out. I think it was the lead up was really stressful. I know when COVID first hit, and because I work on a writers festival, we got cancelled three weeks out. And at the same time, the first event I was meant to go to for the Morbids got cancelled. And I remember I rang my publisher in tears and was just like, is this going to happen? And
yeah.
She was like, well, at this point, yes. And I know books were getting moved all over the place, so she couldn't say for 100%. But she was like, look, we'll do the best thing for the book. Like, no matter what happens, that is our priority. And and I think they have. But as it got closer and things, you know, there was that time where restrictions lifted and we were like, maybe we can do a little bit of a tour. And then obviously things got worse again. So it's just been that side of it's been a rollercoaster. Yeah. But actually having the book out in the world has been really overwhelming in really kind of unexpected ways. It's quite remarkable to have people talking about this thing that I've spent so long crafting and seeing the reactions. It's there's nothing quite like when it finds its people, I think, because there is, you know, one of the things I wanted to do was write a book that spoke to a certain experience of anxiety that I've had, but also that people could look at and go, oh, you know, I don't feel so alone now in what I've gone through, or better understand someone they know because of it. And I feel like I've achieved that, at least, you know, when someone comes to me and says, you know, someone said to me yesterday, I feel stronger for having read this. It's like,
brilliant.
It's not really anything like that, you know?
Yeah. That definitely makes your day, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That's so good. And, of course, that beautiful cover. You must have been blown away when you saw the cover design.
I was completely I was speechless, I think. It's by a Melbourne designer called Laura Thomas. I have a copy here next to me that I'm just looking at because I always look at it.
Gazing at lovingly.
She's done such an amazing job. So it's pink and it's a pinkish tone with a sort of a glitter finish through it, and which really speaks to, I think, both the opening scene in the book and a couple of more pivotal scenes in there as well. And then it's actually got a die cut out of the words "The Morbids" and underneath is a vintage postcard. So it does a really beautiful job to me of almost distilling what the book is about in some ways into just these two pieces of cardboard. It's quite remarkable that she's managed to do that. And I'm still, every time I look at it, I find another layer in the ways that she's related it back to the text. You know, the way the postcards are hidden underneath the die cut.
Yeah.
You know, the way is the same as the way Caitlin hides them under her bed. And there's just so many. But it also, just on a aesthetic level, it is stunning. I see it in bookshops and it's eye-catching and it's distinctive and it's almost quite simple. Like, there's not a lot on it. And
yeah.
I think it really draws the eye. And then it's got that sort of slight sparkle to it with some gloss UV, and it's a stunning piece of work.
It is. It's the perfect packaging for that lovely story. It really is.
And I think it balances. I think when your book is called The Morbids, you really run a risk of people thinking that it's very, very dark. And it obviously has darkness in it. But I think one of the great things that the cover does is balance that with a bit of light and sparkle. And that's what, you know, again, speaks to what I was trying to do, is balance this darkness with some light.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that having that cover, and like you say, the glittery thing and the postcard, it's quite intriguing, particularly when the title is Morbids, you know. Yeah. So I think it's very attention grabbing as well, which yeah. means the marketing people have done their job brilliantly.
They have been amazing. Yeah. Extremely impressed. They've done so well.
What advice would you give, Eva, to authors out there maybe who have a manuscript that they've completed and they're thinking they'd like to try for publication? You know, what would you, but they're maybe a little bit anxious, a little bit worried about what would happen or if they would be successful. What would you say to them?
You know what, I would just say you've just got to try. I mean, you will probably get rejections. You will probably get bad feedback. Before a book is published, I don't actually think there is such a thing as really, really bad feedback. I think when you're still tinkering with a manuscript, anything anyone tells you is something worth thinking about, which in no way means you should listen to everything that anyone says. But I know I loved the editing process because sometimes an editor or someone would say something like, oh, this bit isn't quite working, and why don't you try this? And I'd be like, well, I don't want to try that, but you're right. Maybe this bit could be it's such a evolving your work in that way is an amazing yeah. experience. But I think, you know, it's risky. It is hugely risky, hugely emotionally risky putting your work out there. And it's challenging and it's really, really hard. But there are risks in not doing it as well. Mm. And you don't know what you can do until you actually try and do it. You yeah. know, if you never send that manuscript out anywhere, it's never going to get published. If you send it out everywhere, it may never get published, but there's a chance, you know.
Yeah.
Which all sounds very self-helpy, but is genuinely it's something that I've spent a lot of time trying to convince myself of, and it's something I believe, like, you know, sometimes you just got to take a chance. More on a simple basic level, writers groups are amazing. If you can find writing communities, either through sort of local writing centers, volunteering for writers festivals online, find other writers and find connections, and then, you know, you can go from there. You can start sharing each other's work and critiquing and sort of maybe building a few useful connections. I mean, I don't think anyone should ever go out with the aim of building useful connections as in people in publishing houses, because it doesn't work.
Yeah.
But I think if you can meet other writers, and it also makes you feel better about if you do get a rejection, knowing that every single writer out there gets rejections. I think when you're working completely on your own, it's really easy to feel those a lot more acutely. But if you are part of a community or a group, you know, people talk about it all the time, and you start to realize how normal it is, and maybe that is just going to give you the strength to keep going. But yeah, just yeah. try, just get it out. Just, I personally think having an agent is an amazing thing. My agent, Paul Grace, is constantly getting calls from me, and she's a rock. She's saved me both from myself and in general so many times. So I think if that's something you want to do, for someone like me who needs that little extra push, I think having an agent was phenomenal, and they can negotiate all the tricky stuff. So probably I would say start with agents over publishers, but everyone's different. Some people want to do it on their own, and I think that is completely fair and valid as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Great advice. Really good tips there for writers out there listening. What are you working on now, Eva? Are you on to your next novel?
I'm trying to. I've started several dozen times over the past 6 months. You know, I have ideas percolating in my head. Sometimes they take funny turns, and sometimes they sort of come back to the central. I think I know the next one's a bit different in that I know what I want to write about. Whereas with the Morbids, I had the characters first, and then the characters started telling me what they wanted to talk about. Whereas right. this time I'm coming at it being like, this is a story I want to tell. And so the characters are not quite cooperating yet.
Yeah, yeah.
They're still sort of sitting there being like, what do we do? We don't know each other well enough yet. But I'm taking it quite slowly. I'm not putting too much pressure on myself at this point. I sort of want to enjoy this ride, and I think the other thing is I work in a very intense way. I get things done really fast. So I want to have a sort of a slightly clearer block of time, I guess, where I can really get my teeth stuck into something new without constantly having to sort of come back up for the air and talking about the morbids, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. So where you can just sort of concentrate on the new one and really focus your energy into that.
Yeah, yeah, a little. I'm not the kind of person who can carry too many stories in my head at once.
Mm.
And it's also the other reason is I don't read a lot when I'm writing because I can't focus on a story I'm reading and on a story I'm writing at the same time. So I
have
a massive TBR pile because I'm writing and therefore I'm just buying books but not reading them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I need a certain level of clarity from everything else to be able to get something down.
Yeah. Fair enough. Everyone has their own process, don't they? Yeah, and it's really interesting to hear how everybody does go about it. So, Eva, where can people find you on social media if they want to find out more about you or follow you on, you know, Twitters, et cetera?
Twitters, I am at Eva E. Ramsey, so EwaeRamsey,
mm-hmm.
Which is my name with an E in between. Someone has stolen Eva Ramsey. I don't know who it is.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And there's Eva with a W?
Yep. Yeah. There's an Eva Ramsey on Twitter, which is really weird because there are no other Eva Ramseys in the world.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I'm also on Instagram at Miss Eva, again with a W. So I think the key to finding me anywhere online is look for the Eva with the W because there aren't that many and I tend to come up pretty high these days. Yeah, they're the two main places. I also have a website. I think it's evaramsey.wordpress.com. It might just be evaramsey.com.
But people can Google you as long as they know it's Eva with a W. Yeah, for sure.
If you Google me, Eva with a W, you'll find
all
of my various things. But yeah, Twitter and Instagram are probably the big ones that I use. So that's where you can go. And
great.
I keep people pretty well updated in my mental health and everything else. So
Yay. Well, thank you so much for talking to us. It's been fascinating listening to you talk about your process in creating the Morbids.
Thank you so much. And thank you for inviting me along. It's been really, really good.
Lovely to chat.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Rights for Women podcast. If you enjoyed listening, we would really appreciate it if you could head over to wherever you get your podcasts and give us a rating or review so that other people can find us too. If you want to hear more brilliant conversations with great writers, you can head to our website, www.rightsforwomen.com, where you can catch all the episodes from the Convo Couch and the Anatomy of a Novel series, as well as the Book Launch, a season of episodes created to help authors launch their books in isolation.
And while you are there, why don't you check out our Patreon page? Patreon is how people can support the artists making the work they love. So if you love Rights for Women and want to support us in supporting other authors, become a Patreon subscriber and get some cool little bonuses while you're at it. To everyone who is already a subscriber, we appreciate your passion for our project and thank you very much. You can always find us on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram as well. Thank you for staying home and supporting our authors. This podcast episode was produced and edited by Kel Butler from Listen Up Podcasting. Podcasts for a positive world.